Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Shu Wang. Welcome back to the New Books Network podcast. Today, I feel very happy to invite Dr. James Kyung-Jin Lee to discuss his newest book, Pedagogy of Oneness. So the first thing I want to do is to invite Dr. Lee to introduce himself to us.
Thank you, Shu. My name is Jim Lee. My pronouns are he, him, and I am a professor of Asian American Studies and English at the University of California, Irvine, where I'm also the director of the Center for Medical Humanities. And as she mentions, I'm the author of the book Pedagogies of Woundedness, Illness, Memoir, and the Ends of the Modern Minority. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Lee. That's the question I want to invite you to introduce, to talk about the reason why you are interested in the two fields, Asian American Studies and the Disability Studies.
Sure. I actually write about the origin story of my interest in the intersections of Asian American disability studies in the book and kind of late in the introduction. But in the summer of 2009, in between leaving UC Santa Barbara, which was my previous institution, and joining UCI, I did 400 hours of what's called clinical pastoral education, or a form of hospital chaplaincy internship. At a hospital in downtown Los Angeles. I was assigned to the oncology and surgery floor. And there for 40 hours a week, for 10 weeks, I sat with patients and families and hospital staff, listening to stories of illness and suffering and all manner of storytelling kind of that emerged from acute and chronic illness, disability, and the like. And, I was trained as a literary critic. I have a PhD in English. I've been working for, at that point, more than a decade, or almost a decade. And none of that training in reading carefully and closely prepared me for what I encountered in the hospital. And so I came away from that experience really wanting to learn more about how illness and disability changes the way we kind of think about storytelling, changes the way, of course, we think about embodiment and the like. The director of the program that was part of turned me on to Arthur Frank's work. And so that reading his work really helped me kind of solidify kind of how this could, this initially emotional response to encountering illness and disability then led to a kind of more sustained scholarly interest. And then around that time, a number of my colleagues in Asian American studies started falling sick. And I started listening to their stories. And in fact, one of the people that I engaged with was Jennifer Ho, who was then at UNC Chapel Hill, now at the University of Colorado Boulder. She was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she and I spent, you know, began a months-long conversation about what that experience meant for her. And that resulted in a special issue of AmerAsia Journal, which she and I co-guest edited on what we called the state of illness and disability in Asian American. So I would say that it came from a very personal place, both in terms of my chaplaincy experience and then talking to colleagues and friends in the field. And that just kind of got me interested in more broadly kind of the fields of disability studies and medical humanities. And it just, that was kind of really how I became interested, and that's what ultimately led to the book.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Lee. Let's go to your book. So my first question is to invite you to talk about the first chapter of the book, and especially how about the rise of South Asian physicians writing and their implications.
So, before we get to the narratives written by South Asian American physicians, we kind of have to think about this kind of demographic of South Asian American physicians in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. It's important to bear in mind that, part of the passage of the Hart-Celler Immigration Act of 1965 had a special provision to prioritize what Congress then called foreign medical graduates. If you recall, 1965 is also the passage of President Johnson's major Great Society programs, which included the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, which profoundly expanded healthcare coverage to elderly and poorer Americans. And so you had in the mid to late 60s just this explosive boom in healthcare demand. And the medical system at that point simply didn't have the personnel to meet that demand. And so Congress very kind of put into the immigration bill a provision to invite both foreign physicians as well as foreign nurses to come to help fill that need. And so at the very same time in Asia, particularly South Asia, you have a pretty substantial emergence of South Asians graduating from medical school from India and Pakistan, who are then come to the United States through these special FMG visas. We see a corollary amongst Filipinx and South Korean nurses around the same time. And in fact, my mom came on one of those visas. She immigrated to the U.S. in 1971 with one of those visas. So I think it's important to sort of note that kind of sociological demographic story as a way of understanding why it is that U.S. hospitals become so populated by South Asian American physicians. And why the face of U.S. medicine turns demonstrably brown into the late 20th and early 21st centuries. So that's kind of the first thing to kind of bear in mind. The other thing that is important to bear in mind as to why South Asian Americans become take on the mantle of writing narrative is that many of these South Asian American, mostly immigrants, although not exclusively so, are because India, for example, is a post-colonial country, you have physicians who are also trained in a kind of British system in which the kind of the arts are, if not fully valorized, at least kind of acknowledged. And so many of our South Asian writers, Abraham Verghese, Atul Gawande, it's kind of the perhaps the two most popular medical authorities, they are all in some ways trained in this kind of post-colonial context. It's not lost on me that Atul Gawande was a Rhodes Scholar, right, and studied in England. So you have that kind of post-colonial training and that kind of this idea of a kind of South Asian Anglophone sensibility that kind of they bring with it. So I think those are some of the major reasons why we see that kind of rise. I talk about in the book how these authors kind of embody the bringing together of science and the arts that was kind of disaggregated in the late 20th century, where you have folks, this idea of kind of the two cultures of there being men of science and men of art, but they are kind of in these different categories. And what these South Asian American writers do is they bring the science and the arts back through narrative form and become in some ways these figures of healing that many American readers and patients did not experience in real life. And so I think they become a kind of figure, almost like a guru figure for American readers.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer again. So my next question will be invited you to talk about how the emergence of Asian American medical narrative may be understood in two distinctive but related ways, which regards a modal minority and a medical authority respectively.
So, I mean, one of the things that undergird the book project is this idea that the model minority, and it's important to say this kind of very clearly, and I'm part of a small group of scholars who say this emphatically, that the model minority is not a myth. The model minority, rather, is a racial form, a form of racial subjectivity that many Asian Americans not only live into, but actually desire to. Oops, hold on. Sorry about that. That many Asian Americans not only live into, but desire to live into. And this idea of high educational achievement, high economic and social mobility are kind of values that are instilled into, say, for example, second generation Asian Americans. There is a health corollary to the model minority, which is that the model minority presumes forms of able-bodiedness and able-mindedness that enable the high mobility of Asian American model minoritization. So that's kind of the first thing to kind of bear in mind. And if you think about it in those terms, then the physician becomes a kind of model minority figure par excellence, right? Because when we think of those tasks with the work of curing and healing people, we tend to imagine that our physicians are incredibly able-bodied and able-minded. And in fact, many of the medical narratives that you read talk about the kind of physical endurance that physicians have to undergo in order to prove themselves worthy of taking on the mantle of becoming doctors, right? And so the idea that residents are expected to, you know, go without sleep for 36 hours to be on call, or, you know, surgeons being on their feet for 6 to 9 hour surgeries, right? There's a kind of narrative of physical endurance and able-bodiedness that kind of undergirds the physician memoir. And if you read our Asian American versions, it's striking how almost organic the journey to medicine is for many of our Asian American authors. You know, I teach medical humanities at UCI, and most of my students in those classes are pre-med. And the arduous, almost miserable experience that they endure in the journey to get to medical school is striking. For these students, the desire to go to medical school is the struggle to go to medical school is as hard as the desire to go. And so there's something that's really striking about the effortlessness that our Asian American authors speak of going to med school. It is, in narrative form, no big deal. So that's the first thing that I would say. The other, in terms of the medical authority, I think that many of our authors narrate the journey through medical school and into kind of into medicine, you know, and the kind of formation of medicine as one of gaining a kind of medical authority, medical excellence, kind of reaching that kind of the apex, right? And kind of becoming medicine. And this is one something that many physician authors talk about, this idea of there being a kind of what are called the informal curriculum, kind of medicine as its own kind of culture, that Asian Americans kind of inhabit with a kind of ease, with a kind of authority. What's striking that I write about in this second chapter is when these Asian Americans kind of reach their kind of clinical apex, the height of their profession, they look around them and they begin to see what's broken in medicine. Just as many Asian Americans, not all, but many Asian Americans in their journey to becoming model minorities kind of reach the mountaintop and look around and realize that that journey is actually laden with a lot of brokenness and a lot of systemic problems. And so that's kind of really what the second chapter tries to get at, is as these Asian Americans journey in their medical story, they come to a realization that both the identity, their identities as model minorities and their identities as medical authorities hit a kind of event horizon. And then the question is, what is on the other side of that event horizon?
Okay, thank you so much for your answer again, especially about interaction or intersection of the two perspectives, model minority and the medical authority. So my third question is to invite you to talk about the rise of Asian American illness blogs and the memoirs and their styles.
You know, had I written this book much earlier than as I had intended to, the third chapter would have been me really talking about the lack of Asian American illness memoirs, because when I started to think about writing this book, there weren't any. I mean, you would have basically, in 2011, when I first started to really kind of think about Asian American illness, there were two essentially self-published books written by Asian Americans about their illness experiences, Fred Ho and Brandy Worrell. Brandy's was self-published because when she shopped her manuscript to publishing houses, editors told her that there was no interest in cancer memoirs. Now, that is absolutely not true. I mean, cancer memoirs remain a very, very popular genre. But what the editors were essentially telling her was, we're not really interested in Asian American cancer memoirs. And so the third chapter was really going to be about kind of the lack of illness writing and how that kind of fed into a certain kind of model minority understanding of Asian American embodiment.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But then as the decade unfolded, something broke. And we started seeing towards the end of the decade a flood of Asian American memoirs about illness. And I talk about those memoirs in the third chapter. And what we find is that Asian Americans had been writing about their illnesses in during this decade, mostly in blog form. This was the kind of heyday of the genre or the form of the blog, where people kind of began to express themselves through this kind of digital writing. And It was through these blogs that Asian Americans started to form a sense of community. What's striking is how, I mean, as it is for any diagnosis of a serious, chronic, or terminal illness, the shock of that disruption that illness brings, right? This sense of what Arthur Frank calls narrative wreckage that illness brings to a person formerly able-bodied. You see this very much so in these blog entries of this sudden turn of a diagnosis, or in the case of, for example, Christine Kyung-wook Lee, her experiencing a stroke at the age of 33, the transformative, disruptive nature of illness, and the need on the part of these Asian Americans to try to make sense of it through this form of writing that is in some ways indefinite, right? Blogs can go on and on and on, and some of them do take on this kind of a life and afterlife. And many of these authors, their blogs are still up on the internet. You know, what's striking is that many of these authors in the latter half of the decade, Christine Lee, Juliet Whitby-Williams, who also had a blog about her colon cancer, they found not only a community of Asian American readers, but they also found not just a white readership, but a white readership of stakeholders in trade publishing. And so editors of major presses began to read these stories. And that's when these Asian Americans started getting book contracts. And again, we have a slew of them at the end of the decade. And so what's striking to me about these illness memoirs is how they, in some ways, follow many of the kind of tropes and scripts of generally kind of illness memoirs written by, for example, white people, but kind of shot through many of these narratives is the kind of model minority expectation. And so what do you do with model minority identities, which includes able-bodiedness, when your own body is failing you? And so those are some of the conundrum that I think that I try to explore in chapter three, in terms of how Asian Americans kind of wrestle with that through their development of a kind of a narrative ill voice, as it were.
Thank you so much for your answer to my question. So my next question will be about, I want to invite you to talk about representation of illness in Asian American physicians' scholarly writing.
Okay, and so in terms of that, do you mean are you talking specifically about chapter four? Okay, so the chapter four is titled Illness as Method, and it looks at scholarly monographs. So these are academics who are themselves Asian American in the humanities and in the social sciences. I look primarily at three Asian American academic writers and their respective experiences of illness and disability. There are two scholars who experienced breast cancer, and then a third who experiences a kind of form of environmental toxicity, a kind of reaction to environmental toxicities. And I was interested in the ways that illness transforms the scholarly endeavor, right? Many of us trained in the humanities and in the social sciences are trained to approach our scholarly objects with dispassion, with a kind of emotional, if not distance, a kind of bracketed emotional relationship to our scholarly objects, all in the name of developing a kind of scholarly rigor that allows us to see and critique our objects. What I found in my study of these three authors is that illness kind of transforms, changes, and disrupts that scholarly expectation, that the object of study, when filtered through the experience of, you know, in the cases of these three authors, life-threatening illness really kind of has us reimagine what scholarship is for, and why engage in scholarship. So even as, for example, Lachlan Jane, in their study of the cancer industry, is deeply critical of the what you might call the cancer industrial complex, also treats those who have experienced cancer, those who died from cancer, with an extraordinary amount of care. And that's one of the things that I found that kind of runs through these scholarly works, that alongside criticism, the work of care as a scholarly method becomes paramount, a really kind of crucial foundational kind of value that we often don't see in academic scholarship. And so that to me is a profound, at least for me, was a profound insight in kind of thinking through what happens when the scholarly academic endeavor confronts the vicissitudes of illness and disability. It doesn't always happen, but I found it striking that these three Asian Americans sort of took up care as a kind of critical mantle that is kind of on par with and actually kind of a precondition to what we might consider intellectual rigor.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer for my last question. So I will appreciate you talk about your new book to us again. So now I want to talk to my audience. So I want to say, as a medical historian, as a disability historian, I personally very appreciate reading Dr. Lee's newest book, Pedagogies of Oneness. So I want to recommend anybody with interest in Asian American history, with interest in medical humanity and either disability study, you may consider buying a copy of Dr. Lee's newest book, Pedagogies of Woundedness. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast today. Thank you.
Thank you.